Welcome to the Teachers of Europe podcast, a podcast to support teachers across Europe in addressing common classroom challenges and featuring teachers that can inspire others to follow their footsteps. My name is Ruth Batista, Senior Professional Development Manager for the European School Education Platform, and I'll be your host. Today's episode will explore how teachers can address traditional gender social norms and expectations by fostering positive masculinity. I understand this might seem a complex theme, but indeed, we will discuss how teachers across Europe are helping students move beyond stereotypes using evidence-based practices and real classroom experiences. And to help me to go through this journey, I have with me two guests, Isabel and Daria. Isabel is a teacher of physics and English from Germany. Hi, Isabel. Good morning. How are you?
Hi, good morning. I'm good. Thank you for having me. I've been a teacher of physics and English for the last 8 years at a German high school. So my students are between 10 and 19 years old. I got a great age variety. I got a science. I got a language. So I got lots of gender issues in my classroom every day. Mm.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you for accepting the invitation as well. And good morning, Daria. How are you?
Hi, I'm Daria. I'm very well. I'm an English teacher. I've been teaching English for, I think, over 20 years now. I've actually taught English to everyone between the ages of 3 and I think my oldest student was over 70. So a lot of experience. I'm also an Erasmus coordinator, e-twinning projects and things like that. So that's about me.
Thank you, Daria. And also thank you for accepting the invitation to share with us your practices. Well, I do not have students of those ages, but I do have a teenage boy at home. So as I think maybe my perspective would be of a mom for this topic.
So a mom of 3 children, 2 boys, 2 and 1 girl. They're all in their teenage years now. So
lovely.
All experience in the area.
So let's get started with our conversation. Across Europe, many boys continue to encounter messages, both explicit and subtle, that associate masculinity with dominance, emotional control, and competition. These norms, left unchallenged, can negatively influence boys' relationships, the learning outcomes, and mental health. This was highlighted in the European Commission's report, Gender Equality Strategy. Gender stereotypes remain deeply rooted and continue to limit individuals' opportunities and well-being. This document, the strategy from the Commission, explicitly calls for actions in education to promote equality and challenge such stereotypes from an early age. I don't know who wants to start, but have you seen any examples where boys felt pressured to act in a particular way to fit in?
So I guess there are a lot of small, subtle ways in which this shows in a classroom. Mm-hmm. For example, very often you can notice that boys are more hesitant to engage when it comes to more like opinion-based questions, but are very engaged when you have like fact-based questions. Mm-hmm. I got this boy in my 12th grade, for example. He's very smart. And when we were talking about American history, he just had his hand up like nonstop, like answering fact questions. Mm-hmm. And then we moved on to like short stories and he just disappeared. There were no answers from him about, you know, how do the characters feel? How do they interact? He didn't really want to talk about that at all. So I think that's a good example of where boys try to avoid showing vulnerability and are more comfortable with talking about hard facts.
You have some examples as well, Daria?
Yeah, so mine is a little bit different, but it's a very, I don't know, simple way into showing how boys are kind of pressured to act a certain way. So yes, this one is a quite simple example. So for example, when we have PE and the PE teacher is missing and we have to substitute, she just says, okay, the boys can play football and the girls can do Just Dance. And I oftentimes think, well, maybe one boy or someone would like to do Just Dance and not play football. And one of the girls would, you know, like to play football and not do Just Dance. But it's not really an option, you know. So that's just a subtle way of kind of pressuring boys to act a certain way.
Yeah, well, I do that have a, that example at home. My son doesn't like to play football, and he was actually very good at dancing. So I have that exactly at home. So I fully understand what you're saying. But how do you think these expectations affect boys' emotional development or even the willingness to participate in classes, whatever it is? I mean, PE or whatever class. I know Isabel gave a different example, but it also relates to this. Yeah.
I think that also it's this idea that boys shouldn't cry and show emotions, for example. And it's not necessarily if boys start to cry in class that, you know, they get teased, but it is just awkward. The other boys don't know what to do when a boy starts crying. Whereas, I don't know, if a girl starts crying, all the other girls will go and hug her, try to comfort her. So I think this has huge consequences on their emotional development. So they just, boys sometimes shut down emotionally. They stay quiet, like Isabel said, during activities about self-reflection, about feelings, and they might disengage completely, you know. And it sometimes it can also become a big problem because the only kind of accepted behavior or feeling that they are allowed to show negative is anger. So, and that's, of course, disruptive and not good.
I think it also starts before that, not only crying, but showing any kind of vulnerability at all. So sometimes they will also hesitate to just ask for help in class, which also impacts academic performance, of course, if you're hesitant about showing weakness and asking for help to understand a certain topic. That's also, of course, negatively impacting everybody. So it's not like only the big emotions like sadness or frustration, but also like more subtle things.
Do you think, well, having a 16-year-old boy and he's more into science, math, etc., well, the typical stereotype. So his class is mainly male. So it's mainly composed by boys, only two or three girls. Do you have that that same experience in, or I don't know if you had classes like this or not, but do you think the impact is exactly the same when the class is majority male or not?
Yeah, I think the pressure might be just as high then to perform in front of the other boys, to not show much emotion. And we have this with the older students who can choose certain subjects. So last year I had a 12th grade that almost exclusively consisted of boys. They had like three girls and the rest were all boys. Of course, some of them, they're exceptions to the rule. You know, some of them ask questions, but they were usually the very good students who I know understand things and just wanted to have a deeper understanding of things. But the kids were really struggling. They weren't really asking anything.
Well, the recent success of the Netflix series Adolescence sparked conversations across Europe. I think actually across the world, not just Europe, about the emotional lives of teenage boys and the ways masculinity is shaped during school years. This series was praised for its sensitive and authentic portrait of the adolescence, but it resonated both with young audiences and adults. This conversation raises a crucial challenge for schools. And the challenge, I would say, is how can we as educators allow me to include also not just the teachers, but also the role of the parents, which I believe is crucial. But how can we as educators translate these series insights into classroom practices that could foster more inclusive and emotional safe learning environments? So I would say this is our challenge. How can we create this safe learning environment for our boys, let's say? What does it look like when a classroom supports emotional openness, Daria?
For me, emotional openness in a class, in a classroom, students are feel safe to be honest, to be themselves, so that everyone can really show up as themselves, so that no one needs to wear a mask or pretend that they are someone else, or, you know, it's just about being ourselves. So it's also about me being able to be myself, to show up and to admit that I have bad days or that I'm frustrated or that something is not going well. And I think that that's basically what an emotional open classroom is, so that we are all just, you know, being ourselves, that we are allowed to be ourselves, that we are allowed to be ourselves even at our worst. and that we don't fear judgment from other ones, from other people. So I think that's basically the nutshell. I think the first thing is that I have to be honest and, you know, show myself in not such, you know, well light if something is not working out.
Yeah. Isabel, what small challenges can teachers make to show that it's okay for boys and girls as well to express emotions? Do you have any ideas?
I think we should lead by example, first of all, you know, show our own emotions. As teachers very often, and I feel like in Germany, this is a big thing. We always are expected to be very professional. You do not really let our own emotions be into our classroom environment, to have more like distance to our students. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not always helpful, right? So if we led by example, both male and female teachers showing our own excitement, but also frustrations more clearly, maybe that would encourage students to be more open themselves. Yeah, that would be one point. Maybe also not just praising people for when they do well academically, but also to praise them when they show empathy, when they support each other, just like small things of encouragement to help out students there.
What would be the role of the parents there in creating this emotional openness?
That's a difficult question, I guess, because you know, we can't blame it on the parents, but mm-hmm. we can't also blame it on the teachers. I think that just have to have to create an emotionally safe space at home and at school. You know, so mm-hmm. it's about I can be myself. I can be myself as long as I'm not making someone else feel bad because of the way I'm acting as myself. So that we just have to create an emotionally safe place at home and at school.
Would you agree, Isabel?
I think we also need to prepare students that each student will have different prerequisites from home. Mm-hmm. So some students might be very well adjusted socially, while others still struggle. And, you know, maybe not everybody has the same kind of upbringing. So I think it's very important that we implement strategies in the classroom that help students balance this in the classroom.
Yeah.
For example, we have this, like, it's like a class council lesson each week where the students come together and they discuss their class problems. And there, of course, boys as well as girls work together and try to solve their own problems with or without the help of the teacher, depending how it goes. Mm-hmm. And of course, there also you can praise people for being more empathetic, for showing support of each other. I think that's a very good learning opportunity for them to develop their social competences and to learn from each other.
Do you have any other examples, Daria, of activities or tools that helped, like this student council, that help boys or students in general to talk about how they feel?
Well, there's one activity that's really made a difference in my classroom is the mood meter. Do you know it?
Actually, I don't.
No idea.
Maybe you can explain us a little bit about it.
Okay. So mood meter is like a simple 4-quadrant color chart that helps students identify how they're feeling and manage their emotions then. So basically you have two parts. So you have negative sensations, positive sensations, and you have high energy and low energy sensations. So for example, energy would be like in the red quadrants, because this is high. Anger would be in the red quadrant, because this is like high energy but negative emotion, mm-hmm. negative sensations. And then sadness is in the blue zone, because it's like they're negative sensations but it's low energy. And then excitement is high energy, good sensations, and I don't know, calmness and something like that is low energy but still good sensations. So what they do is each day or each lesson or each week, students place a sticky note on the zone where they're at. It's anonymous, and so there's no pressure, but it just gives like a good emotional read of the room. And then we talk about it as a group where we are, because if we have, I don't know if I noticed that we have even 2-3 students in the red zone, it's impossible to get any work done, because we have to get them out of that red zone, because you can't do anything with a person who is, I don't know, angry, livid, you know, you have to manage it. Mm-hmm. So, and then we talk about how can we manage this? How can we get out of the red zone? How can we come into a different zone? You know, how can we regulate our emotions? How we are all doing as a group? Sometimes we just do, I don't know, mindful exercises, breathing exercises. So I think that's a very good tool that I use, that I use specifically for feelings, you know, moods.
And remind us again, you use that tool with kids of what age?
You can do this from, you know, first grade, because they can put, I don't know, they can also put emojis on it or so everything.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also very good to help teach boys like vocabulary about emotions, mm-hmm. because I feel very often it's difficult for them to express themselves with words and not how they really feel. I mean, anger is easy. They know anger. They're allowed to use anger. But more detailed, more subtle emotions are more difficult. So I think that's actually helpful in teaching them different words to help them express themselves.
Yes, so exactly. We use the mood meter when we are learning vocabulary about emotions. So this is a great way to actually learn all the different kinds of emotions. And I think that language learning actually just naturally full of opportunities to explore emotions, identity, gender roles without really forcing it, because you so often work with imaginary situations. What would you do if? Have you ever? How would you feel if? And students are just constantly stepping into someone else's shoes, thinking about how they would respond in unfamiliar situations. So all you basically need to do is just scaffold them, just give them, challenge them, you know, and put them a bit out of their comfort zone. And then, you know, you can talk about feelings, but you don't really have to talk about how someone exactly feels, but you can do that in a easier way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Even outside of feelings, I feel like that the modern school books really help in making students reflect on their own lives. Like they have such a diverse cast these days, with boys and girls having like non-traditional hobbies or non-traditional families, and the students can just talk about their own families or chores they have to do at home and so on, and compare this to how others see themselves. And they already have these role models then built into their school books, which really helps, I think, to get the conversation started.
And I know at least Daria, maybe please correct me if I'm wrong, Isabel, but at least Daria has some experience with Erasmus Plus and the twinning projects. And I'm sure there's a lot of resources there that support teachers in this area. Do you have any example of how you used Erasmus Plus and the twinning projects to support, let's say, the teaching of empathy and this language?
Yes. So for us, I work at a village school. There's really not that much diversity at our school, you know, because it's a small school, it's a rural school. And basically, it's just because of Erasmus that the students have had the opportunity to, I don't know, meet their first gay person or a boy who uses makeup, you know. So mm-hmm. All very, very challenging things for them. And I think that they would not, they, you know, that would happen much later in life. So I think this is a great way to just kind of expose them to this world and get them to, you know, so I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I totally agree with Daria. I'm also the Erasmus coordinator at my school. And I feel like it's just implied in each and every Erasmus project. As soon as you have kids meeting or them going to a different place or them hosting somebody in their own home, they immediately confronted with a different worldview, and they can just reflect on, okay, like this is how I grew up and this is how I was raised, but this might not be the only valid way to see the world. And there are so many other facets to seeing the world. And to accept this and to maybe also change a little bit about their own personality.
Yeah, that's great. Can you share, maybe Daria, a very specific activity or discussion or even an approach that helped shift the way boys in your class relate to each other?
So, like I said, I use a variety of things. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think it's in English learning or foreign language learning, it's actually very easy to do kind of things. So I don't know, when we are working on the second conditional, for example, I usually give them provocative questions like, what would happen if men had to give birth to babies. And then you have the usual answers. The girls are, of course, happy. The boys, not so much. And you get answers like, oh, I'd kill myself, or the world would end, you know. And then we discuss about it. But I just remember this excellent answer from one boy, because we had all these kind of bad answers, you know. And then one boy, just totally serious, said, if men had to give birth to babies, I would man up and deliver. He flipped the whole meaning of man up, and not to hide emotion or act tough, but to like step up and do your job, you know. Mm-hmm. And we just had this whole conversation about it. And so I just do things like that a lot of times.
Yeah. Do you have some examples as well, Isabel?
I actually have the opposite example to what Daria just said. In my sixth grade last year, one of the boys called another boy, you're such a girl. And then I was like, hang on, what is he meaning with that? So I tried to, of course, first of all, you know, you have to respond, you have to stay calm. You can't yell at him for saying something like that, because where is it coming from? So we tried to talk about it. And what does it actually mean that you call your friend a girl? Like, what is the expectation behind this, and is this really a bad thing? Why is being a girl such a negative thing? And at the end, he kind of realized, okay, this is not really an insult, calling somebody a girl. It's just my expectation or my gender stereotyping that I got from somewhere, because he's in sixth grade. I doubt he has really thought about it in detail, that is just leading me to insult somebody as a girl because this is what is expected in our society.
Mm-hmm. Apart from the examples that you already shared, do you use any specific teaching materials, stories, media, group tasks, whatever, to address gender and identity?
Yes, so I often also use short stories. There is an abundance of short stories that address these things. I particularly like this one story called The Elevator. So it's a kind of a creepy story, a scary story. I don't know if you know it. It's about a boy named Martin who's afraid to use the elevator in his apartment building because this strange, obese lady comes into it. And Martin's father is a very, you know, old school dad. And he teases Martin, makes fun of him because he is afraid of this old lady. So I think it's just a great story to address, you know, male vulnerability, fear. Mm-hmm. Suppressing your emotions and things like that. It's a very good story.
Oh, I'm totally writing that title down and using that in my class in the future. Thank you. So of course, literature and the stories we choose in our classes, that is of course always a great starting point to talk about emotions, how do different characters handle emotions, and so on. Apart from that, in our 13th grade, we have a specific unit on gender that's in the curriculum. But of course, it's more of an academic approach. I would say it's more about, you know, like terminology and, you know, having more of an academic background knowledge on gender. But last year was actually quite fascinating. I had a transgender student in my class, and, you know, my school is also in kind of a rural area. So this was, for some of the other students, rather interesting because he was very open about his experience and his journey to discovering his view on the world. And some of the other students were so shocked. They were like, oh my gosh, what is this person talking about? We have no idea how to handle this. So we had some very great discussions and conversations about gender in this unit. It was very interesting.
Thank you. I believe that also boys can be part of the solution when it comes to tackling harmful gender norms. Would you agree with that, Isabel? How do you think the boys can be part of the solution?
Of course they should be. I think both genders should be equally responsible for tackling this issue. I already mentioned this class council that we do in school earlier, where boys and girls have to work together and they share responsibility of creating an open classroom environment that everybody feels comfortable in. With some nudging and some help, I think boys can be really encouraged to also help others. Instead of just being bystanders, you know, what you usually do, you know, somebody's upset and wants to leave the classroom. And very often you send another kid with them, you know, to comfort them, to make sure they're okay. If you can't step out yourself, so why not ask a boy to go with this person and take care of them for the moment. I think just nudging them in the right direction will be a good step.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Daria?
Yes, so definitely. I think that, but maybe not. Maybe we don't need to really divide it into boys and girls, you know, and just you know, people acting appropriately or students acting appropriately.
And what about you, Isabel? Do you have any? Have you witnessed any moments where kids challenged, not to say boys or girls, kids challenged the stereotypes or supported their peers in a meaningful way?
There are, of course, they're very small things. In younger classes, you do these like reading exercises, you know, reading dialogues with different parts. And I always find it interesting when boys volunteer to read girls' parts and vice versa, and the class doesn't care. I think that's really great. You know, like, oh, this is this boy and he's reading a girl's part. And everybody's like, okay, that's normal. And I think that's awesome.
Okay, well, just a reply to that. That has never happened in our classes because whenever it's like, and I don't have enough girls for the girls' parts or I don't have enough boys for the boys' part, they're all like, oh, no, we can't read it. It's a girl. And then I just say, well, just change the name, you know. So, but we don't do it. We don't just read it.
Well, talking to the teachers that are listening to us right now, what's one small change a teacher could try tomorrow to start making a difference? Maybe we can start with you, Isabel.
I think there are a lot of things that we can do, and small things can already change so much, probably. Mm-hmm. So it can just start with being more aware of empathetic behavior among students and really praising that, not just focusing so much on academia and academic performance. I do this a lot, so this is something I still need to work on. Or praising somebody when they're admitting that they're struggling with the material, you know, like a small step. Oh, you asked for help. That's really good. Keep it up. You know, this is not you admitting to being weak. This is actually helping everybody. But it could also be more in the methodology, for example. If you do group work, and very often in mixed groups, you know, the girls are the note takers and the boys give the ideas or then present afterwards. And if you assign different roles in groups and then have them rotate the groups like every week or whenever you do group work, I think that's really helpful to have everybody on kind of equal ground and to really make a difference in breaking down gender stereotypes here.
Actually, my son has a totally different experience. He was usually the one that had to take notes because nobody wanted to take notes. As I said in the beginning, he's in a class mainly composed by boys. So, yeah. Anyway, Daria, what do you think? Do you have also one small change that the teacher could try tomorrow to make a difference?
I don't think there's like, that change. You just try to start noticing things. You know, and then if you focus on the good things, not on the negative ones, I think that the good things will start to, you know, there will be more of the good things. So if every time you see appropriate behavior, good behavior, and if you just focus on that, I don't know, I've gotten used to saying thank you for listening, thank you for taking note, thank you for doing that, you know. So I think that if you just focus on the good things, that the good things will increase.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like small things, leading by example, showing them a role model of how they can act, that's really helpful. But I agree that we should focus on the positive sides, but also when we notice that a student is really struggling, that we should approach them and just offer that we listen to them if they want to talk, to also encouraging them to be vulnerable and that it's okay to not be okay and that it's okay to share emotions. I think it's also a big part of being a teacher.
Yeah. What helped you both, I don't know, who, maybe Daria, what helped you most when you first started working with this, or have you always worked with this topic?
I think it was just that I noticed certain things because there is so much gender bias that slips classroom without us even noticing it. And I've actually, I started noticing it like Isabel said now that now the textbooks are very diverse, and this wasn't the case 20 years ago. This definitely wasn't the case. In all the flashcards, you know, the policemen were always men, the nurses were always women, the girls were all wearing pink dresses, pink skirts, the boys were wearing blue. So there wasn't pretty much any diversity. And just to notice these things, to just put a spotlight on these things, I think that instantly makes a difference. For example, we had one textbook that had a recurring comic with two detectives, and they were Smart Alec and Sweet Sue. And so I always ask, well, why is it Smart Alec and Sweet Sue? Why can't it be Smart Sue and Sweet Alec, you know? So just things like that. But this has changed. This has changed increasingly over the 20 years. But I think still there is still a lot in the background.
I think it's also interesting that there is still a bias in how teachers are educated. Because I remember when I went through training like 10 years ago, like in science and my physics classes, when I learned to be a teacher of physics, we talk a lot about gender issues, you know, how to encourage girls to be less hesitant about being engaged in science class. But in my English teaching lessons, there wasn't so much talk about, you know, how boys are maybe feeling insecure about opening up. And this was something that really surprised me when I then started teaching. And you just see that the kids have all these biases or all these things that they bring from home or from the playground or whatever that you need to address. So that was quite a challenge for me at first, and quite the, I needed to grow into this, I think.
Yes, but this is also how society works and how, you know, socialization works, because this is just the way it is. I remember when I was teaching first grade English 15 years ago, and you ask, okay, what's your favorite color? And 70% or 80% of the girls would say pink, and 80% of the boys would say blue. And if you had one boy who, I don't know, by some magic said pink, everyone was like, what? How can your favorite color be pink? You know, no way. So, and these are the things that we really need to address. So, yes.
Yeah, totally true. And not even going back 20 years, when I had a seventh grade in physics, they've never had a physics lesson in their life before. And the first lesson, the girls approached me and were like, yeah, we cannot do science. Physics is really too hard for us. My mom said so. And I was like, what? You have no prior experience with physics. In the end, I have some of them who really started liking physics, but that was really surprising. And I was like, what's wrong with you? I'm a female physics teacher standing in front of you. I'm living proof that it can be done.
Yes, but I think that the girls, they just don't see themselves in this. I don't know what is it like now, but I think that even just the examples in physics where it's usually a man trying to, I don't know, push a cart down the hill or up the hill, or a man trying to fix a car, or a man spinning, or a man, you know, it's always, all these examples are just in a completely man's world. I don't know, maybe it's different now, but you don't see yourself in these situations. So it's not your world then.
Yeah, it's actually a great point that we as teachers need to be more sensitive about our language and the wording that we use in tasks, mm-hmm. as well as in classroom communication, right? Not always address everybody as boys and girls, for example, because we also have more genders, or just as guys or things like that, to be more aware, to have more diverse examples, to also include everybody and to make everybody feel engaged in the tasks.
Yes, definitely. Representation is certainly, you know, key, because you need to see yourself in the things that you are learning about. And girls, I don't know, more see themselves in these romantic stories, essays, books. And there was one example which really shocked me just like 2 months ago. So we were talking about the future, and I asked, so where do you see yourselves in 10 years? So in 10 years, I don't know. And all the girls, you know, first all the girls answered, and all the girls were like, oh, so they are now 15, so they will be 25 in 10 years. All the girls said, oh, I will have a husband, I will have a family, I will have a child, maybe, and so on. And I was like, what? And then I said, okay, girls, let's ask the boys. I am fairly certain that none of them will say that they are married and that they have children. And yes, all the boys said, I will have, I don't know, a lot of money. I will have this type of car. No one said anything about wives or children. this is still so embedded in them, I think. You know, everyone, but I think still majority, yes.
Yeah, but it's not, I would say it's not a matter of one being right or wrong. It's accepting the differences.
I think that the gender roles are pretty much defined before they even start school. You know, I think we are still living in a very patriarchal society, and they have this in them when before they even start school from birth. You know, you have the clothes. If you go to a shop, you have the boys' section, the girls' section. The colors are very, you know, have the pink and the bright colors for girls, and you have the dark blue colors for boys. So this is just part of our society. And so even when I was teaching in first grade, and I, for example, I would ask them what's their favorite color, 90% of the girls would say pink and 90% of the boys would say blue. Mm-hmm. So they have that in them. It's not, you know, that's part of the society in showing itself. It's not, you know, their nature.
Very often you hear from students, they say, oh, my parents said, oh, I don't have to be good at math, the girls especially, because my mom also wasn't good at math and girls don't really need math. I'm like, wait, what? We need math everywhere. And thankfully, this has gotten a little better with English, that English is more of a girl's subject. I think that's actually one instance where computer games actually helped a lot. Because they use English all the time when playing online. So boys kind of see the use of English these days a little more. But of course, this analysis of stories, this now working with characters and so on, that's more seen as a girl's area because of the emotions connected to it. But I feel like definitely the roles are perpetuated through what parents teach their kids about what is important in life and what they should learn.
Yes, and not only parents. It's just, it's everything. You know, it's from the society, it's culture, it's TV shows, it's everything, you know.
Yeah. Even when you ask them what do you want to be, like you already mentioned this earlier, right? Especially the young kids, you know, a lot of them will be like, oh, very stereotypical future jobs, you know, girls wanting to be teachers and nurses and things like that, and boys wanting to be cowboys and police officers and things like that. Thankfully, that kind of is reduced a little bit when they go through puberty and they kind of find their own voice. I always cheer for those girls who actually get interested into more stereotypically masculine areas, who are like, oh, I really want to go into, I don't know, law enforcement. I'm like, yeah, go, you go, girl, you rock. Or the boys who are like, oh, I actually want to be an artist. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. You should do that. So I am really cheering for those kids who actually break out of these stereotypes and find their own voice as they mature.
Yes, and that's definitely not possible if you don't have representation from a young age. You know, if you don't see, I don't know, I think there was research on chemistry textbooks, physics textbooks, and there were like, I don't know, 10% women in them, you know? Or like I said before, like flashcards of policemen, nurses always women, nurses always men. So, you know, this is very hard to try to be something if you don't see it possible. That's why I think that also all, you know, Isabel is a hero because she is a girl teaching physics and inspiring so many girls to, you know, to do that. So that's also very good.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Much appreciated.
Well, indeed, addressing traditional gender, social norms and the expectations is a challenge for teachers. Actually, just to add, if relevant or not, but just, you know, those works that the teachers ask the kids to do when they are a little bit younger, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I was actually very surprised with my son's answer because he said, I want to be happy. So I was actually very surprised. And I was like, oh, so sweet. So I didn't have that firefighter or policeman, but he wants to be happy. So I hope that we manage to have that for our kids in the next generation, that they are actually happy. And that's what we should look for. What advice would you give to a colleague who's hesitant or unsure about where to begin addressing this topic?
Well, I would say don't worry so much. You don't have to save the world in one go. You know, relax, take it small. So if you start with like small steps, you know, just listen to the students, listen to what they bring from home or from their peer group or whatnot, and then address things that they bring, because students are naturally curious, and the younger they are, the more open they are, and the more openly they will share things that that bother them or that they encountered. So you can just start there and start a dialogue with them. Listen to them, talk to them about what they think, what they bring from home, but also show your own emotions maybe more clearly. This is my homework for next school year, to be more empathetic there and to share more of your own feelings.
Daria, would you like to add something?
Definitely just what Isabel said, definitely don't put too much pressure on yourself to get everything right straight away. And I think that there is this perhaps pressure, especially on the young teachers, that they have to be kind of perfect, that they have to kind of not show that they are, you know, that they can make mistakes. I think that's a very misguided approach. So definitely be yourself, open up to them. Sometimes I just ask them, okay, so how do you think this made me feel, you acting the way that you are, you know, and then they actually can notice, oh, wow, teachers have feelings. Those kinds of things are very useful, so that students see that you are open, that you are willing to listen to them, and that your classroom is a space where everyone is respected.
Wow, thank you so much. Well, we are reaching the end of our episode, and I would like to ask if you would like to add anything else regarding what we were discussing. Any other thought that maybe you missed that you think it's worth adding? Any other advice to teachers that are listening to us? Anything you would like to add?
I also think that this is a very important topic that is oftentimes kind of neglected or swept under the rug. So I think that we should definitely talk about this more.
I would say be open and stay curious about it. And you're also not alone. You know, we're all in it together. Talk to your colleagues, exchange tips and ideas about things, and get advice from them. And we can do it, I think.
We can do it. Well, thank you so much to both of you, Daria and Isabel, for joining us today. And stay tuned for the next episode.